Hello and welcome to Unfrozen episode number 79. I'm your host, Greg Lindsay, here with Dan Safarik for perhaps what is our most on-brand episode of Unfrozen ever, at least from Dan's perspective. Dan, who's our guest today and why are you going to do all the talking?
Our guest today is Jason Barr. He is a professor of economics at Rutgers University, Newark, and one of the world's foremost experts on the economics of skyscrapers. He's the author of Building the Skyline, The Birth and Growth of Manhattan, and has had his research featured in any number of publications, including several that I edit. And I'm very happy to have Jason here talking about his new book, which is called Cities in the Sky, The Quest to Build the World's Tallest Skyscrapers. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Indeed. So we're excited. I mean, this is obviously, as Greg said, very much up my alley and up the elevator shaft in addition to that. Why is this book needed now? We're kind of in a sort of transition point where we're not sure where the next era of skyscrapers is, what is going to hold for us. There's some questionable things happening out in the desert in Saudi Arabia. We're not really sure if that we're going to see the next tallest skyscrapers out of there. We're not sure what's going on in China. You know, things are a little iffy. So why is this book needed now?
Well, I would say the book is needed now for a few reasons. One is it's a history. It's in some sense I take a long view of the skyscraper. Start in Chicago, bust some myths in about Chicago skyscrapers, New York, the Roaring Twenties, then the United States after World War II, and then beyond, especially focusing on China and the Arabian Peninsula. So the first and foremost purpose of the book is to place today's skyscrapers in a long-run historical context and just to see how they emerged out of this long-run trend. So we tend to view skyscrapers as, you know, because they're so big, they're so large, we just tend to see them as like popping up magically like mushrooms. But it's important to put these things in context. Even in China, where there has been rampant overbuilding, in many respects, they are adapting a model that the U.S. Initiated in New York and Chicago in, you know, really at the turn of the 20th century. So the main goal of the book is to put the skyscraper in a historical context and also bust some myths and misperceptions along the way.
All right, so let's talk about some of those myths. I know one involves the first skyscraper and or the home insurance building. And there's another one that involves the so-called skyscraper index. Maybe we can talk about those two things, which are pretty, the one is very much an inside baseball controversy. The other one may have some implications.
I was going to say, this got real wonky real fast, but yeah, I'm dying to hear these myths.
So let's talk about the early skyscraper controversy first.
Sure. So definitely in like among architectural historians, particularly among architectural historians and engineers and so forth, there's this question about what's the first skyscraper. And if you read Wikipedia, for example, it just represents like the common wisdom that the home insurance building, which was completed in Chicago in 1885 and was designed by William LeBaron Jenney, was the first skyscraper. And a few years ago, CTBUH organized a one-day symposium, and everyone on the panel, except one person, I mean, and the room was filled with experts. Everybody was like, the home insurance building is not the first skyscraper. There's no way this is true. And I'm sitting there at the time, I think this was in 2018 or 19, thinking, wow, like, what's going on here? So I really did some research on this. I went to the archives, the Chicago Art Institute. I looked at Jenny's letters. I went back and looked at all these. Google Books is amazing. It has all the old journal articles, engineering journal articles and stuff like that. So here's the real story. When Jenny designed the building, he was innovative. He had some nice innovations that helped make the building have larger windows and made it better for office space inside the building. But it wasn't until about 1896 when he was worried. It seems in large part he was worried about being sued by an architect named Leroy Buffington, who was from Minneapolis. And so him and his colleagues, they started basically drumming up a public support for the home insurance building. So it became like this PR campaign in around 1896. And after that, everyone kind of believed the Chicago folks that Jenny's building was in fact the first skyscraper. But there's no metric by which you could say it was the first skyscraper. I'm happy to go into more details, but the bottom line is it essentially became the first skyscraper as a PR campaign rather than based on any technological definition or anything like that.
Thank you for reminding me of that that other individual, Buffington, like who held a patent. That is not a commonly known story, and it doesn't get wrapped into the Chicago mythology that you hear. You hear about a lot of other similar buildings rising at the same time using different construction methods, but you don't hear about this Buffington fellow. So I'll have to put that in my next presentation. I'm going in front of the Union League Club in a week and a half, and they will be clutching their pearls.
So I just want to stress or say, and this was a real shocker to me when I was looking at these letters and the files, the historical files for Jenny at the Art Institute in Chicago. And there is a telegram from Buffington to Jenny, which is basically, you are in violation of my patent. Cease and desist all construction activity that is related to my patent. And Jenny was never sued, but it's pretty clear when you dig through those files that he was worried he was going to get sued. And Buffington was suing people left and right. He was always losing, but he was suing people for patent infringement constantly for at least a decade, if not more. The lawsuit issues didn't really pop up until after the home insurance building was completed. So when Jenny designed the home insurance building, he added iron inside the brick piers, and he added these iron lintels that ran across from iron pier to iron pier. So he added iron to the masonry of the structure. But what happened is in 1896, there was in this journal, the Engineering Record, a steamship executive wrote this letter. Who invented the skyscraper? I'm paraphrasing. And when Jenny and Daniel Burnham and a whole bunch of other people saw that letter asking who invented the skyscraper, they all just said, "Oh, it was Jenny. It was a radical innovation. Nobody anticipated him. What he did with the home insurance building was completely new." And they were just mischaracterizing the history in order to boost Jenny and also to try to obviate the patent, but from Buffington. So I hope that answers your question.
Indeed. Okay, moving outside from the core of the baseball, inside the baseball, let's talk about the global theory of the skyscraper index, which has been quoted throughout the media ever since it emerged. What's incorrect about it?
Okay, so I think in 1999 or so, there was an economist who made this claim that the world's tallest buildings are completed right at the peak or right after the peak of a financial crisis of some kind. And he suggested that you could use the height of a record-breaking building as somehow an indicator that the economy is going to downturn. That's why it's called the skyscraper index. It can be used to predict the so-called skyscraper curse, which is the super tall building somehow predict or determine in some vague way what's going to happen with the economy in the near term. So it's what I call Rorschach economics. The world record has only been broken 12 times since 1890, but downturns happen at least twice as frequently as that. So what happens is, it's true, during the boom upswing, somebody will announce and often complete a world record-breaking building, but the economy is likely to downturn anyway. So you can't actually use building heights to somehow predict or forecast what's going to happen. I mean, I've crunched the numbers. We've done all kinds of statistical tests, and there's absolutely no way you can use building heights as some kind of an indicator for what's going to happen to the economy in the future.
So you're saying there's a chance the line is not doomed us all. Or really the Jetta Tower or whatever the next project's underway there. But it does make a sort of anecdotal sense. Does it feel right to you? The Rorschach blot is a very apt phrase there too. But it is interesting. I mean, you know, in the sense of watching these edifices go up at that particular point, particularly fueled on credit and whatnot. I'm not saying it's true, but at least do the 12 map. I mean, does it at least show that does happen on the eve of crises because of what's happening in speculative bubbles and credit markets?
No, I mean, actually, I looked at all these buildings, all the record-breaking buildings, and I looked where they fell within the U.S. business cycle. So most are announced during the uptick, about half opened during a downturn. The number of months between when the building is announced and when the cycle peaks, or when the building is opened and the cycle peaks, there's very little connection between the two. I mean, generally speaking, you know, world's tallest buildings get built when things are good. But when economies downturns, generally economists actually are very bad at forecasting when the economy is going to turn down. Because there's so many factors at work. And using a skyscraper to sort of say, oh, the economy's overheated and we're about to have some kind of crisis, there's just no connection. It's has a truthiness to it. So it feels right. Like it feels like it should be right. But when you drill down, you just don't, it just doesn't, the smoke and the mirrors disappear.
Well, to me, this gets to more fundamental questions separate from the inside baseball questions, which is, Jason, what is a skyscraper for in 2024? Because if a century ago they were effectively, and you can tell me I'm completely wrong on this, but effectively a century ago they were, you know, stacked, vertically stacked factories for paperwork, and we think of the skyscraper as intrinsically an office building, that is completely reversed, where we intrinsically think of a tall building now for residential. And of course, the profusion of office parks, Joe Gross, Edge City, we can go back through there. But in 2024, why should one build a skyscraper? And what are the programs for it? And how do they pencil out in this post-hybrid work age, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to start with like the huge sort of picture from, I don't know, 10,000 feet or whatever, which is that, let's start with the big picture, kind of some statistics. You know, in 1960, the world population was 3 billion, and 1 in 3 lived in cities. So the global urban population was 1 billion. Today, global population is 8 billion, and like 60% live in the cities. So that's like almost, you know, whatever, 4.5 billion people live in cities. And that number is just going to keep getting higher and higher. And so, you know, from an economist, the question is, if all these people want to be in the same place at the same time, and, you know, they want to economize on transportation, and they want to be able to, you know, work, live, play in relative close distance, the only way to accommodate that economic activity is by going up. I mean, if you have... So this is sort of the general overview, but I'll get to more of your question in a second. But just if you have like a 10,000 square foot lot and you're going to house people, maybe that lot can comfortably, a quarter acre, can, you know, densely built, can accommodate 25 people. So if you stack, if you do that 20 times, you all of a sudden have 500 people that live literally at the same latitude and longitude. And that's fundamentally what's going on. Now, obviously, COVID and work from home radically transformed, particularly in the United States, where people are spending their work hours. So I have two responses to that. One is that it doesn't get rid of the office building as we know it. It may just cause some repurposing of these buildings. It may... you know, people are waiting. There's going to be economic growth. Employment's going to rebound. So even if there's not, let's say, as many, if people aren't coming into the office as frequently, eventually there'll be more people and there'll need to be more seats. But the other thing is just economic growth in general means that there's, you know, people want to live in the city. They more money just means more stuff to spend on going to shows, eating in restaurants, and things like that. So, if you want me to clarify or if you have more follow-up questions, I'm happy to answer. But at the end of the day, as long as there's urbanization, there's going to be tall buildings.
I think there's an interesting question of chicken and egg here, too, that relates to that relationship between tall buildings and urbanization. Because we've kind of seen it both ways. I think it's perfectly logical to look as a global phenomenon at urbanization as a driver of rationale for densification in general and then tall buildings specifically. But you also have situations like, you know, new build cities in the Middle East where there wasn't much of a population at all, and they built the tall buildings almost before they built the cities. You know, I think you have a pretty strong argument around, for example, you know, the placement of the Burj Khalifa, the world's tallest building in Dubai, which is on your cover, kind of driving development around it. Now, it was helpful that the developer of that building also owned the surrounding property so that they could then say, buy this apartment, you will have views of the world's tallest building. That not everyone has the ability to clear land and have that kind of gambit. But have you looked a little bit at the cause and effect relationships, you know, of iconic tall buildings being constructed and then being followed by civilization as opposed to the other way around?
Okay, well, the first thing is, if you look at where the tall buildings are being built, they're in either global cities or cities with global ambitions. So you don't see the world's tallest building being built in smaller, medium-sized cities. I know they're talking a lot about this Oklahoma City tower. I'd be shocked if it's completed. If you look at the size of that tower relative to its population, it's a complete outlier. It's such an outlier that no city of such a small scale, such a small size, has ever built something so tall. So in the case of the Burj Khalifa, I mean, I don't think what people understand about the history of Dubai, and I talk about this a little bit in my book, is really Dubai's idea of big project development happened in the 50s with dredging the creek, and they built this dry docks for repairing ships. And so by the time the 21st century came around, Dubai had already been sort of urbanizing and building big infrastructure projects. And so in some sense, the Burj Khalifa represents kind of like the 21st century version of this, which is to help advertise the city as a place for investment, for real estate investment, for business investment, and it worked. I mean, you know, it really put Dubai on the map. And also, I was crunching the numbers too. I got some real estate price data from a real estate company in Dubai, luxuryproperties.com, and I statistically looked at the value of an apartment if it had a Burj view. And it was 15% higher than the apartments that didn't have the Burj view. And like you said, because Emaar owns those properties, those sales, that extra premium from those sales likely paid for the construction of the Burj Khalifa alone. I mean, I know people talk about the Burj Khalifa as being like ego and vanity, but from an economic point of view, it's sheer genius, I have to say. And it's reminiscent of the Empire State Building. People criticize it too big, too tall, but it's the most beloved building in the world. I mean, it may have been ego, but it was also genius and economic, a gut economic feeling that actually panned out.
And I mean, you know, we also focus a lot on the outlier buildings that are the tallest and the most remarkable in each city or each geography. But I think there's a general principle that you've unearthed as part of your research, which is that there is a consistent premium for height that happens as you go up floor by floor. I remember you recount the story quite hilariously in the book, because you had arrived at this conclusion before the person who thought they were presenting it for the first time.
Yeah. Right, so if you look at apartment prices, for example, in New York, Chicago, wherever, or in Dubai, as you get taller, the apartment prices go up. And same thing with office rents. So the same space, like it might be a two-bedroom apartment and have exact same layouts, exact same appliances, but the one on the 10th floor will sell for like 10% less than the one on the 20th floor. And that the fact that people are willing to pay more to be higher is an important component of the economics of skyscrapers. Again, we talk about ego and the developer like just wanting to have monuments. But the truth of the matter is when you actually crunch the numbers, the occupants, whether they're office occupants or residential occupants, want to be higher. I've actually done another – actually, I mentioned this in the book. I did another research study with a co-author of mine, and we tried to figure out how much of the height premium in apartments is due to views versus other things. And it seems like – we call it the status effect. You could also call it the self-esteem effect. But let's say, for example, that you go up 10 floors and you're paying 10% more. Half of that is for better views, and half of that is just for people to be able to say, I live on top of the other people. It's just a human nature, I guess, to wanna feel like you're in the higher up in the hierarchy.
Yeah, we've certainly seen that in some of the insane acrobatics that have gone on along, say, Billionaire's Row in New York, where there's so much existing construction along the south edge of Central Park that you actually can't even start having views until you're 40 or 50 stories up. And so you've got these sort of essentially pencil-thin towers with townhomes stacked on top of each other that don't even begin until, say, the 40th floor. And everything below that is mechanicals, amenities, things that are not quite as view-dependent. I mean, that's the extreme version of that. And I think people probably pay a little too much attention to that as a way of generalizing the long-held understanding that goes back to the early 20th century that skyscrapers are, in fact, built equations that do need to pencil out or people lose money. That's certainly true in all models of, I'd say, Western capitalism that we're familiar with. But you've also spent a lot of time in China where things are a little different. And they've been building a lot of skyscrapers, and now there's some bad news coming out of there that a number of real estate developers are going belly up and are relinquishing their foreign investments, and there's a general sense that things are slowing down. But of course, it's a somewhat opaque economy. What's your take on how we got to the Chinese skyline we have today, and what do you think is going to happen in the next couple years?
These are great questions. So what happened, again, I always take the long run view, so you'll humor me on this. In 1978, when China initiated its economic reforms, there was no such thing as private property. And they didn't know what to do. So it turned out that when they created Shenzhen as a sort of a bench, like an export oriented city to kind of be China's kind of economic window to the world, they had to figure out how to develop the city and how to create a land market. So they looked at Hong Kong. Since the Hong Kong government owns all the land, it leases the land rights to developers. So when Chinese officials saw that, they said, oh, this is a great idea. The municipalities can hold the land, can own the land, and just sell the rights to developers. So what happens is, over the decades, Chinese officials initiate the process of selling land use rights to developers. And because many of them are interested in promoting their city because they want to get promoted to up higher in the Communist Party, they just had this incentive to put more and more of these large lots on the market in order to gain the revenue from the sale of the leases to pump back into infrastructure. And so it kind of created this feedback loop where the Chinese officials in a city would sell the land use rights, would get the money, would buy infrastructure, which would open up more land and sell the land use rights. And so from the supply side, the Chinese officials were really pushing economic growth through building high-rise buildings. But the other side of it is both economic growth, and also there's this real desire among Chinese households to own real estate. They put their savings in real estate. And so even some of these ghost cities where the Chinese officials would push the building of these brand new cities, the units would sell. So if a city was out in the West part of China, there would be households using their savings to buy in Shanghai or Beijing. They would pump their money into these units. So some of the developers, they got their money back on the project, even though these units were barely occupied. So in China has this really unusual combination of Chinese officials pushing land use, Chinese officials selling land leases, and households putting their savings in real estate. And it just kind of bubbled up. So as to what's going to happen in the near future, obviously, I can't use skyscraper heights to make the prediction. That's a joke. But it's hard to say. I think, as you said, it's quite opaque. On one hand, the Chinese economy seems to be growing. The economic numbers for economic growth, I think, was like 4.5%. If that was the United States, that would be considered like a miracle. But on the other hand, the Chinese housing real estate prices are still falling. The government's trying to stave off the damage. So to be honest, I don't have any strong predictions other than in the long run, the market will eventually stabilize and rebound. But beyond that, I'm not going to venture into China's near-term future.
There's a lot of politics wrapped up in that in a much more thumb-on-the-scale fashion than we have heretofore been able to exercise in terms of things like interest rates. I'm sure that our political officials would love to have the tools they have in the Communist Party of China to control or put a stop to certain trends in the economy.
That's true, but at the same time, after COVID, there was just a lack of confidence among the Chinese households and consumers, and so you have these kind of self-fulfilling prophecies where people are afraid to invest their money or to spend their money, and then the economy does poorly and just reinforces those negative expectations. So even though the Communist Party and the Chinese government has a lot of tools at its disposal, at the end of the day, household and consumer perceptions are very hard to change. And that takes time. And if you look at the Japanese case, you know, it's taken decades after its financial crisis a long time ago.
Well, given the fact that this seems to be a moment of transition for the skyscraper with a lot of sunk costs and a lot of need of coming up with new programs for them, what are your thoughts on the office to residential transition, the idea, well, we have a crisis on one hand, we have a crisis on the other, maybe we can put the two crises together. But it seems, as an economist, it seems like that is extremely difficult to pencil out, only really works for older buildings with have better light cores. Do you have any hope for that particular hypothesis, or is that really a dead end, do you think?
Well, I have neither hope nor is it a dead end. There are some buildings where there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. And so if the core is not that far away from the facade, it makes a lot of sense. So the low-hanging fruit will happen pretty quickly on its own. Those big office buildings from the 60s, 70s, 80s with these huge floor plans, they're not going to change without massive subsidies. In my opinion, there's also the problem of the waiting game. Developers are just hoping interest rates fall. They're just hoping office usage bounces back. They're hoping the economy's bounced back. And so the waiting game, again, creates this self-fulfilling prophecy of everybody's waiting. Nothing happens because everybody's waiting, and the market just chugs along slowly. And officials seem very reluctant to really make bold moves. And it's like in New York, everybody's just waiting it out. And so that's the problem. The problem is mostly the waiting game. Nobody knows quite what the future is going to be look like. So everybody's just kind of holding their holdings as best they can. And the other reason it doesn't pencil out is because the only way an office to residential conversion, I wouldn't say the only way, but generally speaking, office to residential conversions make sense if the new buyer of the building can get the old office building at a tremendous discount. Many property owners are just not willing to sell their old office buildings at the kind of low ball prices needed to make the conversions work. In New York, they came up with a figure of something like possibly 20,000 housing units could be created through office conversions. But if you consider there are 3.6 million housing units in New York City, 20,000 divided by 3.6 million means it's not going to do anything for like the housing affordability issue. It will help keep the downtowns a little bit more vibrant. But yeah, so that's kind of my take. Maybe it's not as a very specific take, but it's, I think the answer is in 4 or 5 years, these offices will probably get more people back in them. Some of them will go back to being successful offices. Some of them will be torn down, and some of them will be converted to residential. Maybe that's not very specific.
Well, you've got all the bases covered there, so that's good. We are actively trying to figure out the potentiality that you just illustrated with the research project that we've got underway now for what is at the moment an undisclosed client. But it's really tricky because you can look at the potentiality, but then in terms of the spatial logistics, or the age of the building, the turnover, but that also doesn't tell you anything about the appetite of developers, because it really does kind of come down to personalities and people negotiating, and there's just this uncontrollable human element to it, that it, to the extent that skyscrapers are built equations, we can do a lot of math on them, but we can't ultimately predict what people are going to do, in terms of individual decisions.
Right. I mean, if you're a building owner and you have an office building that's half full and you paid a lot of money for it, you're not ready to sell it at the kind of discount that would initiate some kind of either refurbishment or some kind of conversion. So you say, all right, I can make my interest payments. I'm going to add some pickleball courts and Starbucks, and I'm going to wait it out. And I think for a lot of office building owners, that's what they're doing. I mean, interest rates are so high, they can't really do anything with refinancing or anything like that. So it's just this waiting game. It's just a waiting game. That's what the problem is. And officials, again, seem to be reluctant to really push people to make changes.
Well, speaking of changes, the other question I wanted to ask, Jason, in addition to the office residential conversion, so more seriously, going back to the line for a moment, I mean, some of the proposals that get leaked out of this call for, zero gravity living, I believe is the name of the book they put out at the Venice Biennale last year. Do you see fundamental changes in the construction, use, et cetera, of skyscrapers? Are they effectively going to be elevator cores with things around them? Are there any technical innovations in the way that we once took the, building core of concrete in the Empire State Building to the skin and structure of the building around World Trade Center? What is the future of the skyscraper from a built perspective and programmatic, that in terms of where we can push it further?
That's an interesting question. I mean, really, there's two things. One is demand, right? So most skyscrapers today, the super talls, tend to be for apartment living. So I would just say that developers are building these super tall condos because that's really where people, because people want to live in the city, or they want to have a second property so that they can come visit, things like that. And the other thing I think is important to keep in mind is how cities zone and regulate these buildings. I mean, there's this obsession in the United States with having only a single use. Maybe you have mixed uses in the sense that maybe if it's a little retail on the bottom and offices on the top. But I think the future of the skyscraper needs to be more flexibility. Let different sort of stacks of floors have different uses. I think they're more open to this in Asia, where you might have offices, residential, hotels, malls. So we're not willing in the United States, it seems, to really let the different floors have different purposes based on the different demands. So I think that's one thing we need to be more mindful of. I mean, as for the future, I'll just leave it at that. I don't know if that gets to your question exactly, but, as technologies improve, buildings will make living there in tall buildings more comfortable, more I think there's also a resurgence. I mean, you know, this Oklahoma Tower that they're talking about, I feel like it reflects a broader trend in the United States where people are more likely to live in tall apartment buildings. I have a theory. I haven't really done any research on this, but you know, the horrors of public housing, I think they're sort of fading from the collective memory. And given how expensive it is to buy a single-family home, given how people want to be on their iPhones, they don't want to be driving, given how people don't really have this memory of the shock and the horrors of bad public policy as it relates to public housing, I think we're seeing a kind of a mini renaissance in apartment living. And you know, I think a lot of middle size and large cities will benefit from that if we see a return to the center.
It certainly sounds like places like Nashville are really catching the upswing of that. You know, not only is there a good deal of new construction, but it seems like every day a new tech company is saying that they're moving there. Like Oracle just decided to leave Austin after having been there for only a few years. I'm just, it's interesting to see like the resurgence of, you know, middle America, you know, with these, and coming with new construction as well as renovation. I'm pretty encouraged by, you know, the story in Detroit, even though it is largely kind of the story of one person's largesse, which is, you know, Dan Gilbert.
Well, even in Newark, where I work, I mean, my campus, the Rutgers Newark campus, is just sort of on the edge of the downtown. But in the surrounding, let's say, surrounding half mile, I mean, there's a huge number of apartment buildings going up, new apartment building going up. So even an older industrial city of Newark, which had a hard time, there's definitely an increased interest in living in central cities. I mean, Newark's public, where I am, the public transportation is great. The access to the downtown, access to Manhattan is great. And I think people are really coming to appreciate to sort of city living in a way that, you know, I think the idea of the suburban lifestyle, single family house, two cars. Again, I don't have any concrete evidence of this, but my perceptions is that that kind of living is not really necessarily seen as the ideal anymore.
Well, that part's debatable, but it is interesting to know. I'd say it is interesting to know that there has been studies by I forget the name of the, I think it's the BID in the core of Philadelphia, for example, but there is studies to show that, yeah, that actually the number of residents in American central cities is higher than the pandemic, even if total overall footfall is still down because of lack of commuters. So more people have moved to the cores. But this will sound like a stupid question, maybe, for the two of you, which is, has anyone actually built a moving index of average building height or like building canopy height in a major American cities? And I think about this because this is about 10 years ago. Karen Seo at Yale did this using weather satellite data, where they did manage to have at least a rough approximation of the cores of cities around the globe. And they found, for example, broadly speaking, that, you know, that the cores of New York and London, for example, were tall, but not growing up very quickly or out very quickly. You looked at like Uttar Pradesh, India, massive mega sprawl across there. So huge land cover, but not much height. And China was the only place at the time, again, 10 years ago, where you had massive height increase and massive sprawl at the horizontal level. But do we have anything finer grained to like basically track down to like the foot level or 10 foot level of sort of how our skylines have changed? It'd be very interesting to see whether, you know, I imagine the general drift upward, but like, you know, perhaps not by leaps and bounds. But yeah, has anyone tracked that?
We would be the people who would do it if they did. And I don't think we have to that level of granularity, but we could. If you know a sponsor who wants to carry that research forward, I can commission that tomorrow. Maybe Jason has a more concrete answer.
Well, I don't have a concrete answer. My answer is, If you look at New York, the tallest completed building each year, it was flat for many years, and then, you know, in the last 10 years, it's bumped up. So, you know, tall buildings in New York City are getting taller. I mean, they're regularly taller than the Empire State Building, and that was very unusual for a long time. If you have latitude and longitude, if you have the building height, the age that or the year it was built, and the latitude and longitude, for all these different cities, if you had the longitude, I don't think the CTBUH building database has latitude and longitude for the buildings, if I'm...
We do, but not all.
Not mistaken.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, if you had that, it would be a relatively simple exercise to track where buildings are going up, how tall they are, when they are. For my other book about the Manhattan skyline, I looked at the Midtown Manhattan and the waves of the office sector. And you can see there's this great like 20s boom. And then after that, this post-World War boom happened outside of that. And then, you know, in the 21st century, there's this kind of infill. So you see these kind of... you know, it start a core starts, then there's an expansion, and then there's an infill, and that happens a lot. I think that's happening a lot today, but I don't have any concrete data that I've looked at. So, but I think more broadly, I think skyscrapers or buildings in general in central cities in the U.S. and abroad are just getting taller over time. The technology is getting so much better, and the economic demand is getting higher. So these two forces are just driving buildings to get taller. I mean, it's cheaper to build these buildings now than it ever was in the past because of, you know, high strength concrete and just computing technology and things like that, and knowledge about wind bracing and things like this. So in a way, the building boom of the 21st century has just helped make building taller buildings easier, and that's helping all cities build a little bit higher than they would have in the past.
Well, that is a great shining ray of optimism that we can conclude on. Jason, I want to thank you. Jason Barr, author of Cities in the Sky, A Quest to Build the World's Tallest Skyscrapers. It's really great to have you on Frozen.
It was great. Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.